Barack Obama said in 2006 that we're living in a world where we're now getting the man-made or the human-made natural disaster. And I think that's a really good summary of what's happening, that these changes are no longer part of the natural world, they're part of the world that we have created. So the sense of a natural disaster has itself changed. So we are getting more extreme events, both in the frequency of events, how often they occur, and the intensity of the events. So there's two senses of this more extreme climate. And this is a graph that's now 5 years old, but this is just recording of flood and wind and drought-related disasters over the last 30 years. And you can see when people say there's no evidence that the climate is becoming more extreme, even just measuring these sort of events, the climate is, in fact, becoming more extreme. And if you put the money value of those events, this is just the frequency of events, not the cost of the events. If you add the money value in again, you get an even more extreme story. So a bloke who runs US National Climate Data Center, who's chief of their climate analytics, says the climate is changing. Extreme events are occurring with greater frequency, in many cases with greater intensity. So I think one of the really good, well, clear messages that we can say is that climate change is now, not in the future. I think a lot of talk about climate change is that these are things that will happen at some future time. And I think now, in people's lived experiences, they can see that climate change is happening right now, certainly after the last year, if they hadn't before. So in the last year, a record number of countries, 19 countries around the world, recorded the highest maximum temperature they ever have. In Russia, we had an extraordinary heat wave and fires and crop losses that were so severe that after that event, Russia banned the export of wheat out of the country for the rest of the year, which was one of the events that led to record high food prices. So climate food prices is happening. In Pakistan, they recorded the highest ever temperature in Asia at 53.5 degrees, and those extraordinary floods, which dislocated 20 million people. And the rain that affected those floods, that created those floods, was no greater than in previous events. But climate change is actually shifting the monsoon. So in Pakistan, the effect of climate change has been to move monsoons from river valleys with flood mitigation to river valleys without. So once again, the effects of that event was not that the rain was greater, but that it happened in a different place, an unexpected place. And of course, the events in Australia. Often in defence of these events, we would hear scientists and deniers saying, oh, these are just one in 100-year events, one in 1,000-year events. So I think it's important if we reflect on what's happened in the Amazon in 2010, this last year, there was an extreme drought with some record lows in rivers and more forest fires. And people said, oh, that's a one in 100-year event. But in fact, 5 years ago in 2005, there was a similar event in the Amazon, which people said was a one in 100-year event. And I think just from that we can see, as the head of the US Federal Emergency Management Agency has said, the term 100-year event has lost its meaning. And indeed, the governor of Victoria, who's just retired, Professor de Kretser, said the same thing in the Melbourne Age when the floods were on in January and got into trouble from the normal sources from saying what is obviously the fact of the matter. If we come to the recent events in Australia and the floods and rains, the driver of these extraordinary events is simple. The sea around Australia, the ocean, is warmer than it has ever been. So this graph, which is sea surface temperatures in Australia for December, clearly shows that the water around northern, in fact the whole of Australia, but particularly around the north and the east and the northwest, is warmer by about 0.2 of a degree than it has ever been. And the driver of these changes are warmer oceans. The warmer the ocean, the warmer the atmosphere above it, and the warmer the atmosphere, the more water vapour it will hold. I mean, we get the sort of monsoons we do in Asia because the atmosphere is warm and holds more water vapour, hence more intense rain. In very cold climates, it comes out as snow and ice very quickly. So warmer water, warmer air, more water vapour in the air, extreme events. The link is very clear for floods and cyclones. So the question then, of course, is, but is this related to climate change, or is this just an extraordinary event? And with a lot of these events, it actually requires climate scientists to sit down after the event and analyse and statistically work out whether this event would be likely to have occurred without climate change. But Kevin Trenberth from the US National Centre for Atmospheric Research actually jumped on it pretty early and said of this warming, this La Nina situation that we had over Australia, which also produced those incredible flood events in Asia, said a portion, about half of the degree, of ocean temperatures around in northern Australia this summer could be attributed to global warming. So there is a clear link, and I think over time we'll have peer-reviewed science to demonstrate that. Can I just say, and this PowerPoint I've put up as a PDF on the web, and I'll give you the link at the end, so don't worry about the detail, but there are a number of events that have occurred where there is now peer-reviewed literature saying global warming was significant in this event. You remember in 2003 there was an extraordinary heat wave in France, and particularly in Paris in 2003, where somewhere between 30 and 50,000 people died in that summer, in addition to the normal mortality rate. And so there's been an article in Nature which says about half of the excessive heat that summer in Paris can clearly be attributed to climate change, and similar work's been done on floods in England and Wales and the general intensification of flooding events in Europe. I'm just trying to make the point, when deniers and people say, look, you can't link particular events to climate change. In fact, there's peer-reviewed science to say that we can. I think the more important element, and it's important for us, is Kevin Trenberth again, who says, and I think this is really a really great statement, it's not the right question to ask if this or that storm is due to global warming or natural variability. Nowadays, there is always an element of both. I think that's a really powerful statement. Always an element of both. There is a systemic influence on all these weather events nowadays because of the fact is that there's extra water vapour in the air that there wasn't 30 years ago. And I think to say, when people say, is this event caused by climate change? You say, our climate has changed. There is always an element of blame because the system has changed. And some research just published in Nature looking at this and people's response, I think, is also encouraging, and there's a message for us in how we campaign. Those who experience flooding express more concern over climate change, see it as less uncertain, feel more confident that their actions will have an effect on climate change. This translates into a greater willingness to save energy and to mitigate climate change. Highlighting links between local weather events and climate change is therefore likely to be a very useful strategy for increasing concern and action. So that's a good news story. I want to talk about some recent climate events, because I was asked to do so, which will be challenging. So you know that last year was the equal highest in the record, that the last decade was the highest in the modern record, and that climate impacts are generally happening sooner and at a more intense level than the science expected. So I'm going to go through five or six of them. All but one happened to do with the oceans, because I think that's a story that we don't understand enough. The most devastating piece of research I have found, which came out last year, is a study which finds a 40% decline in phytoplankton in the oceans in the last 60 years. And the reason for that is quite simple. They sit on the upper level of the ocean. The food, the nutrient-rich part of the ocean is down, and you need an overturning from the deep ocean to the top of the ocean to bring nutrients up to the top. When you get a warm layer on top, it almost insulates and stops the overturning of the ocean, and the nutrients don't come up. So that is, and this is one thing that James Lovelock always said would happen in his books, you might remember. The second one is our oceans are becoming more acidic. More carbon dioxide in the air means a proportion, about 40% of that, is absorbed by the oceans. As it's absorbed, it's transformed to carbonic acid, a very weak acid. So our oceans are now 30% more acidic since pre-industrial times, and for hard-shelled animals, that is animals who have calcium carbonate in it, this acid can get to a stage where it actually affects them. So our oceans are now more acidic than they have been for 20 million years, and they are acidifying 10 times faster than 55 million years ago when there was a mass marine extinction. One example from CSIRO in Hobart, to a little... in fact, they were on... I think 7:30 report or late line last week, little animals called pteropods, little shells that have wings called sea butterflies. They're doing a lot of work on them, and now they're getting images that are looking like this because the level of acidity is starting to chew in to the shells. So Donna Roberts from CSIRO in Hobart has found that in the Southern Ocean, pteropod shells are 35% lighter than they were 10 years ago, and by about 2030 they'll hit a tipping point. That is, their capacity to build shell calcium carbonate will almost be balanced by the level of acidity. In terms of ice sheets and rising sea levels, there's new work out which confirms work last year that both for Greenland and for the West Antarctic ice sheet, the rate of melting is continuing to increase. So those ice sheets are very slowly starting to go. As you will know in Australia, and there's a lovely story in The Age today about how the new planning minister has taken over the planning rights for sea level rises in coastal communities from councils to himself. Councils around Australia have a range of a sea level rise of 0.9 to 1.1 metres as being indicative for planning purposes for the next 100 years. And the science in America now saying we should deal with 2 metres. So that'll be an interesting issue when they work out that they've issued a whole lot of planning permits that are scientifically out of date. So that John Church, who comes from CSIRO and Hobart, is the world's leading expert on sea level rises, said, and coming back to the 1 in 100-year story, by 2100, the current 1 in 100-year coastal flooding could be happening every year. Climate change will produce more rain, but in different parts of the world, and if you want to understand this issue, there's a great report, it's all in one document, called Drought Under Global Warming Review, from Wiley, which says that what they project is increasing drought and therefore aridity, desertification, in most of Africa, southern Europe and the Middle East, most of the Americas, Australia and Southeast Asia. Don't scribble all this down, you can get the PDF. The last thing in this bit is that extinction rates are now somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times they were before humans started doing what they're doing to the planet. And Wilson, the great ecologist, says he expects that we'll lose half our species by the end of this century. And so there's clearly a discussion about, are we at the edge of the next and sixth mass extinction in history? And there's a peer-reviewed paper just occurred in Nature which says there are clear indications that losing species now in the critically endangered category would propel the world to a state of mass extinction, which is what the biologists generally think. So, sorry about the bad news. I'm just a messenger. Let me just talk about where we're going and targets and what we need to do, which will lead on a short discussion about the politics. In 2009, the most important scientific paper of the year was a paper published in Nature called A Safe Operating Space for Humanity. The second author, there were 28 authors, they were all there, and the second author was Will Steffen from the ANU, which is an irony we might come back to. And it established boundaries, safe boundaries for the planet on 8 different levels, and I'll just highlight the first one. So on climate change, it said that carbon dioxide in the air used to be 280 parts per million, it's now 387, a little bit more now, and they said under 350 now. I think it should be a good bit under 350, but just to make the point, because I think Will Steffen is part of Tim Flannery's Climate Commission, and I doubt in their discussions around the country about climate science for the public that he'll be saying 350 is a boundary, because of course it would clash with the government's view that it should be 450. So if anybody goes to one of those events, and Will Steffen was there, it would be really nice for you to ask him whether he thinks his peer-reviewed paper in Nature saying under 350 should be Australian government policy. And I'd like you to email me the response. More recent this year, James Hansen, who I think partly inspired Philip and I to write Climate Code Red with his work, came out and said, and there's a diagram for this as well, something really important. The last 10,000 years is known as the Holocene. It's a period of human settlement. In that time, the climate has been really steady and really level. The temperatures fluctuated by less than half a degree from the average. And he says now climate change is getting up to the top of what it's been. The temperatures are getting to the top of what it's been in the last 10,000 years. And as soon as we get above that, we're in trouble. So he's saying at, you know, where we are now, 0.8 to 1 degrees, we're on the edge of the precipice. The idea that the precipice is at 2 degrees or so is not valid. And he also said that goals of limiting human warming to 2 degrees are prescriptions for disaster. Might be another nice question for Tim Flannery or Will Steffen. So just looking at this diagrammatically, and I'm sure you've seen this before, this is just a little chart of temperature over the last 10,000 years. We came out of an ice age on the left, and we've been in that blue zone for 10,000 years, and now we're about to leave it. So since the fossil fuel revolution, we've gone from there to there. So we've gone up about 0.8 of a degree to the top of this range of Holocene temperatures, which have kept the climate and sea levels relatively constant. And I think the view is that the danger is somewhere up there, you know, some way to go. And what Hansen is saying is, no, the danger is here. He says, from where we are now, there's not a lot of cushion left. And I think that's sort of significant for us to understand. So just to go through a little exercise about, which leads to a conclusion about some comments that Tim Flannery made recently. There's a whole lot of work about a carbon budget which says, I know 2 degrees is not a good target, if you want to keep to 2 degrees, you've got to have this many tonnes of carbon. That's 120 tonnes per person on the planet, equally divided. The Indians will last 60 years because they have low emissions. We'll last 6 years. And if you see that diagrammatically, we're the black line. Us in America, the black line. We're supposed to be at the zero before 2020. So going back, we need to be at the zero by 2020 for 2 degrees. And 2 weeks ago, Tim Flannery said, if all major emitters adopt a similar level of effort of a 5% reduction, we're on target. And the question, of course, is should science determine politics or should politics determine science? And Ross Garnaut, in his review this year, an incredible science review you can get from his website. We have scientific reticence. We underestimate the risks. It's going to be more urgent than even the scientists are saying it. We need to adjust our expectations as it goes on, and we're probably going to have to look at drawing down carbon from the atmosphere because of where we are. So his science report is really good, a great summary. Conclusions. The present level of commitments will lead us to 4 degrees of warming by 2100. 4 degrees looks like that. Blue, more rain. Red, orange. Australia will be about 6 degrees warmer. That part of the world is probably unlivable, and probably that as well because there's no rain. So there's a climate policy dissonance, and this is where I'm at the moment. A safe climate is well under 1 degree. The politics is heading us towards 4. We can't redefine the science to suit the politics. So, and this is a statement from a paper just done by Tegan Edwards from YCAN and John Wiseman, the pragmatic view that there's still time to roll out a measured step-by-step reduction in emissions in ways which do not fundamentally threaten continued growth of material living is a false realism. I think Paul Gilding's book, The Great Disruption, really brings this, that, you know, we are in disruptive times, not doing anything will be disruptive. Doing the action that needed will also be disruptive because many of the norms of this society are going to have to change, and if a big disruption is coming one way or the other, maybe we should start talking about that. And to finish, there is a 4 degrees conference going to be at Melbourne University here on the 12th of the 14th of July. People like Shellen Huber, who's the advisor to the EU and the German Chancellor, is coming out. He's sort of the guru of 4 degrees. It'll be, I think, a fantastic opportunity to try and convince some people what's going on. He's the most politically savvy climate scientist in Europe and perhaps the world, and recently he said political reality must be grounded in physical reality or it's completely useless.